Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series where we explore the science fiction field from all angles, covering the past, the present, and the future. We're your hosts. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
And we also have a guest today on the line from Canada. It's friend of the podcast, Emmanuel Dubois. Hello, Emmanuel.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Now, he's here for a good reason, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, as we often do, some responses to our last episode. You may recall we reviewed a recent issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And we had a couple of responses. Actually, we had two responses from Jim, who's one of our regulars. On Facebook, he said, "I love your podcasts where you review magazines and you quote my comment even." So, and there we go. I've done it again. And he went on to make some detailed comments on sacrificial drones, which is one of the stories that we reviewed last time. I won't go into all of the detail, but there's an interesting thing. He said another reason why he didn't enjoy the story, even though he thought it was well written, is, and I quote, "because it's like many modern science fiction stories crammed with a decade of technological speculation out of Wired magazine." So, yeah, I felt that too. It felt like the story was full of buzzwords. But even so, it was a fairly decent story. Later on, we have a quiz. But a few weeks ago, and I can't really remember how this happened, but somehow, somewhere, I mentioned something about Destination Moon. And I was meaning the 1950 film. You know, the George Powell film. But in the strange way that these things happen, this prompted Emmanuel, or maybe it was me, to mention the other Destination Moon, which is a Tintin story. And we decided, therefore, that today we would review the two science fictional Tintin stories, Destination Moon and Explorers on the Moon. And since Tintin is translated from the French, who better to join us than a native French speaker? Emmanuel. So, Emmanuel, when did you first discover Tintin?
Oh, you know, as a small kid, Tintin, for us Francophones, is more than huge. I mean, it's, take whichever cultural icon is the biggest that you have in the States or in England, double it, and you have what Tintin is for us Francophones. I mean, everybody knows the stories, the characters. You go to any bookstore in France or Belgium or here in Quebec, and you will see still Tintin albums on the shelves and often prominently, you know. I honestly do not know any French kid that hasn't read some Tintin books or even all of them. Just to give you a small idea, you know the French president Charles de Gaulle? And you know how he loved himself, you know, and how big a guy he was. And he said that his only rival in the international scene was Tintin.
Oh, wow.
Even though Tintin is Belgian, not French, but, you know, it's part of the French-speaking culture, you know.
And does it bother you that we call him Tintin rather than Tintin?
You know, one has to be permissive. it's okay, you know. I understand that this. I'm a French guy living in Canada, so I'm perfectly aware of which French words are hard to say for an anglophone. And I know the sounds are especially hard to pronounce. Yeah. So you're forgiven, my friends.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Colin, when did you first discover Tintin?
The name was familiar to me. I think I was aware of it, but hadn't actually come across any Tintin content until the Spielberg movie.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm. That's quite late.
It is. Yeah, it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I first became aware of Tintin on TV because here in the UK, I think probably from the late 60s onwards, we had the first Tintin TV series. And I always remember it being in black and white. I think some of it was made in colour, but we probably only had black and white copies in the UK. And they were just 5 minutes long, so they were heavily episodic. I gather they weren't too faithful to the original stories. Oh, but then in the 90s, there was a sort of a reboot, and I remember watching quite a few of those as well, and I was quite impressed with those. And I think those were more faithful.
Yes, the series from the 90s is quite faithful, I would say, to the books. They did some editing, of course. They didn't have much of a choice, but it is very close to them. But the one from the 60s is or 70s is very... It's inspired, let's put it this. It has none of the original dialogue. It's basically the same settings and characters, but with completely different, actually, storylines or plots.
Right.
I don't know how it was produced or anything, but the one from the 90s is still the one that makes authority, if you want. They never made another one. Mm. It's still the one that my kid watches right now.
Yeah.
You know.
And Colin, on your other podcast, where you talk about adapted science fiction, have you ever tackled Tintin?
We have not, mainly because we weren't aware of anything that was definitely science fiction. Although now knowing that there's a Nelvana Ellipse adaptation of this that's animated, I think we should definitely take a look at it.
Yeah, I think you should.
It's amazing how huge Tintin is in, you know, French culture, and how invisible it is in the States. It's remarkable. I mean, I've been to the States quite a few times, and, you know, most people don't know about Tintin.
I think, therefore, he's probably better known in the UK than in the States. I mean, I remember seeing the books in the school library, probably in the public library as well. In fact, I think in the school library, we had the French books, you know, the French language editions. And I think they were there, obviously, for people who are doing French as a subject. What we're looking at specifically then is two books, well, published as books, but presumably published in strip form prior to that. But two books, which are, I think, from the 1950s, correct me if I'm wrong, Destination Moon and Explorers on the Moon. Mm-hmm. And Emmanuel, do you know the titles of those in French?
Yeah, of course. It's Objectif Lune, that's the first one, Destination Moon. So it's pretty straightforward translation. But the second one is very different. It's On a marché sur la Lune, which means we walked on the moon.
Interesting.
Yeah. Some titles are very, for some reason, adapted. Others are very straightforward translation. I don't know why.
Well, that particularly applies to the characters, doesn't it? Because obviously, in English, apart from Tintin, whose name is preserved, but we pronounce it differently, all the others have been renamed. Captain Haddock as one of the characters. Snowy is the dog. What are they called in French?
Hergé, the author, his real name was Georges Rémy, by the way. He was a genius with the French language. He used the language and twisted it in ways that cannot be translated well, you know. Like haddock, the name of the captain, means, of course, the fish, you know, haddock. Yeah. But also means a duck in two words in French, which means at the dock. And he's a captain, a boat captain. you know, and a lot of stuff like this. Snowy is Milou. Then you have the professor, Calculus, in English, I think. Yeah. And in French, it's Tournesol, which means sunflower.
Yes.
And you have the policemen, Thompson and Thompson, who are Dupont and, Dupont. And you can cannot have Frenchier names than Dupont.
If you just watched the films, you probably wouldn't know that Thompson and Thompson are spelled differently. But yes. I think I've always thought that was quite clever, that it's got the two permissible English spellings of the word Thompson, one with a P and one without.
It's the same in French. The ending are different. One with a T, one with a D.
Yeah. So I always thought that was a very clever transliteration of those names.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Would anyone like to attempt summarizing the plot of these two books? And should we treat them as one continuous story? Because it seems to me that it really is one story that just kind of is broken in two at the end of Destination Moon.
Yes, it's one big story.
Colin, are you up for that?
I can give that a shot. Tintin, our character, is summoned to Sildavia by Professor Calculus because he wants their help on a project. And it turns out the project he wants their help with is a moon rocket. And that's why this is science fiction, because in 1957-58, no one had gone to the moon yet, especially by a nuclear-powered rocket.
And so in terms of where the story splits, we've kind of got everything, including the launch, in the first book. Mm-hmm. And then the second book really has the landing and what they do on the moon.
And the return.
Yes, and the return. And, of course, there's a subplot to do with enemy agents or whatever, I never really understood what the enemy people were trying to achieve there. But anyway, whatever they're doing, they are defeated. And what do we think of it as science fiction?
You know, the cool thing about science fiction is I don't think that we really... There are people that want to be gatekeepers, but there really aren't any gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. And this is science fiction.
Yes.
It's very well researched. I think it's very scientifically accurate.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's 12 years ahead of its time.
Yes.
I was a little taken out in Explorers on the Moon, because when Captain Haddock leaves the ship, he temporarily becomes a satellite around an asteroid. But that asteroid's actually very far away. It's not between the Earth and the Moon. And so there was a destination question I came up with, but that's small details.
Is it between Venus and Jupiter or something?
Yes.
The details of how that rocket works, I thought, were quite good. And the fact that it used one form of propulsion to get off the ground in the first place, and then it used nuclear propulsion to give a constant acceleration so that there would be artificial gravity, which is a perfectly valid thing to consider. Nobody has ever actually done that with a spaceship, because I presume it would be too expensive.
And if you forgive the historian in me, it's actually 1952, so it's 17 years before the Americans went to the moon. It's before Sputnik, you know.
Yeah.
So he had to guess a lot of things, but he clearly did, as you said, Colin, a lot of research, and not everything is perfectly accurate, but most of it works and it's believable, you know?
Well, and some of the details, like the subsurface water and ice on the moon.
Oh, yeah.
I thought was a fantastic ad, and quite accurate, because you can't have water on the surface of the moon, but down in the caverns and stuff, it is certainly possible for there to be ice.
The other thing that I thought was really good is the design of the rocket, the sense of scale of it. I'm just looking now at the cover of Destination Moon, and you've got the rocket in the background with this very large set of gantries surrounding it, which really does look like the kind of gantry that you would see around the Apollo moon rockets back in the 60s. And in the foreground, you've got a kind of a Jeep with Captain Haddock and Tintin in it. And the perspective on the drawing is wonderful. You really get a sense of the Jeep being close to us and the rocket being in the far distance. There are tiny little people clambering over the gantry in the background. Mm-hmm. So you get a sense of this being a long way away and yet still being an enormous rocket.
If I may say so, the rocket that they're using is probably the most known artifact, you could say, in the whole Tintin catalog. Mm-hmm. That everybody knows that rocket in France, more like, you know, I know people who don't know the Enterprise. I don't know anyone that doesn't know that rocket.
Right.
And if you want to see it, go to Brussels. They have a huge one, like 15 foot tall, in the lobby of the airport.
Wow.
And I think on the Grand Place de Bruxelles, they have a huge painting of it, which reproduces that cover.
Wow.
And do you know the inspiration for those rockets?
No.
Especially the first one. You know when they do the testing?
Yes.
That they have to blow up? It's almost a copy of a German V2 rocket from the Second World War.
Oh, right, yes.
Designed by von Braun, because, you know, I mean, as I said, it's written in 1952, just 7 years after the war. So for a writer at that time, a rocket is that. It's von Braun's design, you know, the war rockets. And then, you know, it evolved into that famous huge rocket in which they will travel. But yeah, it's directly inspired by what, you know, by the war experience, which I think is very interesting historically. And so is the conflict that they have after, with, you know, with, as you said, the, you know, spying and the other nations that you don't know much about. But you don't know much about it because to understand those nations, mm-hmm, you need to have read Tintin stories from before.
Right.
For example, the bad guy, you know, the colonel.
Yes.
Yes.
He comes from a previous Tintin story, King Ottokar's Scepter in English, I think. Le Sceptre d'Ottokar in French.
So the bad guys from this story, are they a constant foil for Tintin and Snowy throughout all of his adventures, or are they just one of a bunch that kind of come and go?
Yeah, it's more that. Like, the bad guy here, the Colonel Boris, is part of one story before, just one. He was trying to force his king and master to abdicate. The king, what's his name, Muscar, in Sildavia. And Tintin prevented him from doing so. So now he's an agent working for some country to, you know, to to steal the rocket and also to have his revenge against Tintin. You will see that a couple more times, I think, like Tintin forces a bad guy's endeavor, and then the bad guy comes back, I don't know, five albums later to get his revenge. Yeah. The most common one is called Rastapopoulos. Like his big head, huge nose, mean guy, and yeah, I think he's the only villain that comes back like four or five times in the storylines. Mm-hmm. Müller comes in two times, I believe, three tops, Boris just two. It's and there's Alan also, like a bad boat captain, which is like the evil Haddock, if you will. So you have recurring characters, but you don't have like one guy coming back all the time.
Looking through now at the design of every element of the ship, we even get a kind of a plan of the rocket where we see how the floors are laid out. Because it is using constant acceleration, it does have, therefore, artificial gravity. It does, therefore, have an up and a down inside. And it's all designed around that. And before they go into the rocket for real, they're wearing some kind of suit which looks a bit like a diving suit. And it all looks very plausible. Then to top it all off, Snowy, the dog, mm-hmm. he has a suit just like all the others. And the same is true when they go onto the rocket and they've all got spacesuits. He's got his own little spacesuit. I think that's terrific.
Milou never leaves Tata. Never.
Well, except when they get separated.
But you see how far he will go to get him back.
Oh, absolutely.
That was one surprise I had about the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, Snowy goes down into the cave and Tintin goes after him to rescue him, and they find the ice. And then the spy reveals himself on the rocket ship, the one who stowed away.
Yes.
And so they were not going to have enough air. And I'm thinking, yes, but they just found a bunch of ice. And so, of course, Professor Calculus, being the scientific genius that he is, will rig up a way for electrolysis and will extract the oxygen out, and they will have enough to get home. But that isn't what happens. There's a completely different, much more dramatic ending to the story than that.
What's that short story, the famous science fiction short story, where there's a stowaway on the ship and it endangers the very mission of the ship? The Cold Equations.
The Cold Equations, yeah.
It's got that kind of vibe to it, hasn't it? That there's a limited amount of air, limited amount of supplies, and yet there are too many people on this ship. And that's even before they've found the villainous stowaway is there. They've already got too many people because Thompson and Thompson are there.
Yeah.
So there's more people who should be there.
And I love the reason why they're here, you know.
Which is what? I can't remember why they're there.
It's because the launch was at 1:34 a.m., and they thought it was PM. And it works a bit better in French, because in French we won't say 1:34 for the afternoon, we will say 13:34. We right. speak in 24 hours.
Yes.
So it's even funnier in French, like how dumb are you to recognize this? And you're a policeman. So it's part of the joke. And I want to say that Hergé uses Haddock and the Thompsons a lot to lighten the story, you know, to have it,
yeah.
to bring lots of humor in it, because it is colder than most of Tintin's adventure, I have to say. You know, you have a lot of science in it, especially in the first part. I mean, the first book is basically everything happens in a research facility. There is not that much adventure in it.
Yeah. yeah.
So he uses them, you know, to counterbalance that. And I think he does it masterfully. Especially the episode with Haddock and Calculus, when Calculus gets amnesia.
Yes.
And you can see the devotion of Haddock to try to help him. And that's very... He's the most human of them all. You know, Tintin is a bit too perfect at time, and that can get tiring. Haddock is here to counterbalance that. He's an alcoholic. He has a huge heart, though. You know, he wants to help. He has a bad temper. He's goofy. But he's very kind and very human. So I think it's a perfect balancing act between the two.
And what I like about Snowy, of course, is he makes little comments that we as the reader are aware of, but I don't think the characters in the scenes know that Snowy is talking, because they never respond to anything he says. So he's kind of talking through the fourth wall. He's talking to us.
Yeah, I like that too. It's like there's an appreciation for how smart animals are that we often don't see.
Yes. And there's a strange bit in Destination Moon. I think it's in Destination Moon, where Tintin he's gone outside and he's sort of climbed up a mountain, and he encounters a family of bears, and it doesn't really lead to anything. It's just like a little side story. Was I missing something there?
I don't think you were, but I recall discussing this kind of thing with my dad because he read those as a kid when they were released. And as I said, they were in magazines. So sometimes you have a small story like to end up the magazine release just to have an end, and then you start at a logical point after. So he told me that sometimes you'll see that kind of stuff in some stories and they make more sense in the releases than in the actual album.
Right. And what did you think of that character, Wolf, W-O-L-F-F? Mm-hmm. Now, it seemed to me that all the way through Destination Moon, there didn't seem to be anything questionable about his behaviour. And it's only towards the end of the second book that he is sort of revealed as being in cahoots with the villains. He later redeems himself and he's on our side again by the end of the story.
I see your point. He explains how he got blackmailed.
Yeah.
It works for me, you know, and he explains actually how his behavior changed during the time of the story, because he said that when he came to work on that rocket, he thought he left all this behind him. So he was, you know, his mind was free. And it was during they were working that they came back to him and they tried to force him to first give some information, and gradually it became downright treason, you know. You recall at the beginning of Explorers on the Moon, when there is a big crate falling on Calculus and Tintin has to save him.
Oh, yes.
We later understand that, you know, that was Wolf. And he tried to push Haddock also.
Yes, of course, yes.
So at the time, you don't know it.
Sure.
And then at the end, you say, oh, okay, that's why. You know, I do recommend reading them a few times.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think I should.
It's very rich, honestly.
Colin, what did you think of the plotting?
I didn't have any problems with it. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Okay.
I like the twists and the turns. Not knowing a lot about Tintin's background, I really wasn't taken out by the fact that they're spending most of their time on a base and most of their time on a ship. Although I think in typical Snowy fashion, Snowy does a lot of problem-causing and rescuing, as you kind of expect from the dog sidekick in a show. So that was pretty good. It took me a little bit of time to get used to the antics of Haddock and Thompson and Thompson, and even Calculus. The gag about his hearing wore thin after a little bit.
Yeah.
Even to the point where he was trying to use the captain's pipe as an ear trumpet. So
these are recurring in all the albums, you know. Everybody knows that Tournesol is deaf, but he says, I'm not deaf, I just have bad hearing in one ear. You know, but he's completely deaf, you know.
Yes.
And in the it allows Hergé to do lots of gags. Like, he's deaf, but he understands what he wants to understand. In other albums, like, Haddock will say something to counter him, and Tournesol will say, oh, thank you, Captain, for understanding me and going my way. and Haddock, being the nice guy that he is, just, you know, cries a bit and yells his various insults, you know, that he has a whole vocabulary. I have actually a book on Haddock's vocabulary.
Wow.
You know, mille milliards, mille sabords, all this stuff. I don't know how well it translates in English, but in French, it's so delightful. It's just beautiful.
Well, the most common thing he says is blistering barnacles.
Yeah, that's mille milliards, mille sabords.
Yeah, they're different colors that all begin with B, or there's a billion blistering barnacles. Or
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I liked about Snowy, as Colin said, sometimes Snowy gets them into trouble, sometimes he gets them out of trouble. But he's always there, and he's always sort of at the edge of the frame. And one of the bits I liked is they've got this thing where when the ship is taking off or landing, the acceleration is so great that everyone falls unconscious. They have to lie on these mattresses face down, and they're kind of crushed by the G-forces. And so they fall unconscious. At one point, possibly at more than one point, I can't remember, Snowy has to wake up Tintin. I think Snowy's role is multifaceted. He's able to do all sorts of things to help the story along. I'm looking at the imagery, and there's one really nice panel where Calculus and Wolf and Tintin looking out of this porthole, and they're looking down at the Earth in the distance. And I think it's Calculus saying, "The Earth, our good old Earth, seen from over 6,000 miles." That was a really nice image that very much is a kind of a pre-echo of what we would see in the Apollo missions in the 60s. So there's that really nice thing. A couple of pages onwards, there's a nice image of the moon as seen through the porthole as they're approaching the moon. And it sort of reminds me of the imagery from the Apollo missions. And then there's a little bit where the gravity goes off, because I think it's one of the Thompson twins accidentally turns off the rocket, so they lose their artificial gravity. And Haddock has poured himself a drink, and it floats up as a little ball of whiskey. And that is so beautiful to see that, because that's one of the things that, since astronauts existed in real life, they've been demonstrating what happens to liquids in zero G. And we've been amazed by this, you know, seeing astronauts create little spheres of water. But Haddock was there first, and he did it with whiskey. That's terrific. That reminds me also that these Tintin books have something in common with the George Powell film, Destination Moon, which is this idea that being weightless is a problem. Now, we know from, 60-odd years of spaceflight that being weightless is quite helpful. Destination Moon, the film, has people... I can't remember whether they have magnetic boots or whether they have Velcro, but they have something to hold them to the body of the ship in the absence of gravity. And there's the same thing here in the Tintin stories, where they put on special boots to bind them to the ship. People saw that as being a problem with zero G, but we now know that it isn't.
Well, it isn't if you train for it properly.
That's true, yes.
The Thompsons hardly qualified then.
Yeah. In the Spielberg adaptation, yeah, which came out, I think, in 2011, there's a callback to that making a little bubble of alcohol as they're flying an airplane.
Oh, really?
The captain smuggles a bottle. The captain finds a bottle of medicinal alcohol, and he's been on a dry spell, and he wants to drink. And so he opens it, and out pops this little bubble of alcohol because they're diving right then. But Snowy ends up drinking that one, and he gets a shot at the next time that they go up and down to have his own drink.
I've reached the section now where Captain Haddock is floating around outside. This is one that we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. That was the only section where the physics is a mixture of being exactly right. So in terms of floating around attached to a tether and the tether being loose because they're weightless until the rocket engine is turned on and then the tether goes taut. So the physics there is correct. But then there was something about the physics that was not correct, and that was to do with how difficult it is to actually maneuver one object in relation to another in space. And this is something that it took the Gemini and the Apollo programs to fully work out, the idea of rendezvous. In space, if you want to move from A to B, it's not just a matter of firing your rocket and heading the way you want to go, because most of the time you're in orbit around something else, so you're not really travelling in a straight line. So it's sort of having the intuition of how to get from A to B, which may not be by going the way you think it's going to be, if you see what I mean. And I think the Tintin story is just a little bit naive about how easy that's going to be to rescue Captain Haddock. But even so, it's better than a lot of science fiction from that time.
Yeah, and I think it's to his credit that he actually uses science and gravity as plot factors.
Yes.
These books were aimed at, you know, the slogan was 7-year-old to 77. That was the title, like in the magazine, from 7 to 77. So, and teenagers were the main readership. And you read that, and, you know, even though, as you said, it's not perfectly accurate, there's still a sense of scientific accuracy here.
Yes.
And it's very well executed in terms of drawing and storyline, and then you have Tintin yelling at Haddock for being a drunk, and, you know, and which is one of the few times where he loses his temper. You know, as I said, Tintin is little Mr. Perfect, and he rarely loses his temper, but when he does, it's effective. And it just works in the story, you know, and... Even though it's not perfectly accurate, I still think it's charming and it's nice that he uses science that way.
Yeah, I completely agree there. Now, the same can't be said of the Thompsons and this bizarre thing they have in this story where their hair keeps growing.
And changing colour.
And changing colour, yeah.
Yeah.
That's from the previous book.
So what was the cause of it in the previous book?
In the previous book, Au Pays de l'Or Noir, which translates literally, I don't know the actual title, but it's Black Oil's Country. It's basically Saudi Arabia.
Okay, yeah.
And you have like factions fighting for petrol.
Yes.
And you have Tintin going there, and you have a bad guy. And the Thompsons, at some point, they ingest a product that was put in oil reserves that would contaminate them. And that contamination would make the engines explode. But at one point, they ingest that. They take that. They think it's a medicine, and they take it. And it has this effect.
Right.
That their hair will grow indefinitely and change colors all the time. And once in a while, they have, it comes back. You know, they've been treated, but it comes back. So it comes back strong in that book. And even in future releases, they will just, you know, have like a hiccup and blue bubbles coming out of their mouths. And they say, sorry, it's because of a past mission in Arabia. So it's one of the running gags, you know. He uses it a lot in this book because I think Pays de l'Or Noir was the one just before. So it's still fresh, if you will.
Right.
Then less and less with the next storylines. But it's still funny, you know. And it's part of their goofy humor, yeah. You know. You know, they go in circles and they always do everything together. Like at some point, they see tracks on the moon and say, there are two people that work here. And somebody yells at them, well, maybe it's you, just find your own tracks. It cannot be. We're alone. And there's two tracks. Then it's like they never acknowledge that there are two people.
Brilliant. I've just called up the cover of the previous book, and the previous book in English is called Land of Black Gold.
Mm.
And on the cover, it's got Tintin driving a Jeep, and Snowy's there, of course, but sitting in the back seat are the Thompson twins, and they've got long blue beards sort of blowing in the wind behind them. So, yeah, I can see that that was a key plot point of the previous story. And then I'm just looking through to the bit of the moon landing, because there's something. I wanted to look at the first words that are said. Yeah, here we go. Tintin is the first person to actually set foot on the moon. And when he's standing in the doorway of the rocket looking out, he says this. He says, "It's, how can I describe it? It's a nightmare land, a place of death, horrifying in its desolation. Not a tree, not a flower, not a blade of grass, not a bird, not a sound, not a cloud. In the inky black sky, there are thousands of stars, but they are motionless, frozen. They don't twinkle in the way that makes them look so alive to us on Earth." And that struck me as being a beautiful description. And it also echoes, or pre-echoes, what Buzz Aldrin said when he set foot on the moon, because he described it as magnificent desolation.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder if he'd been reading Tintin, because Tintin describes it as a nightmare land, horrifying in its desolation.
I'm pretty sure it was popular among the astronauts.
Yeah. And then when he actually sets foot on the moon, he says, "This is it. I've walked a few steps. For the first time in the history of mankind, there is an explorer on the moon." So not quite as poetic as what Neil Armstrong said, but, you know, still pretty decent words.
Yeah, and in French, of course, he says, "On a marché sur la lune," we walked on the moon.
Right.
Or "man walked on the moon." It's a bit closer to Armstrong.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the title of the book, isn't it?
Yes.
And then we see Snowy being lowered down on the end of a rope. But then he goes running off in his little spacesuit, which I think is lovely. And they discover that gravity is less on the moon than it is on Earth. So once again, I think all of this is much more convincing than in that George Powell film, which is famed as being the first proper science fiction film. So I wish they'd made Hergé's story instead of that thing. The one thing that makes me realise that Professor Calculus's rocket must be much more powerful than the Saturn V, and that is that they've got this, well, it's a tank. They've brought a tank along with them. You know, the heaviest vehicle you can imagine has been brought all the way to the moon. And, of course, the rocket is very large and spacious inside, and that contrasts so much with what we know from the Apollo missions. The Apollo, you start off with a huge rocket, but the only bit that makes it all the way to the moon, back to the Earth, is this tiny little capsule. But in Hergé's story, obviously, it's a powerful enough rocket that you can take, what is it, about 7 people? And you can carry a tank as well. So his engineering is obviously far in excess of what NASA were able to achieve.
Well, of course, he's French. Sorry.
Actually, he's Belgian.
True. Well, we actually don't know. That's the thing. It's never... It is stated like that Tintin is Belgian. Mm-hmm. It is stated that because you see his passport in whichever story, I don't recall.
Yeah.
But the other guys, they're never... We never really know where they're from.
Oh, I see.
Although it's a little late, I was struck by how accurate the spacesuit design was. You know, there have been such a variety of spacesuit designs since the 1950s, but the idea that you would need movable joints and visibility and portable air, it even shows antennas so they can talk to one another.
Yeah.
For 1952, that's remarkably scientifically accurate and forethinking.
Yeah. And, of course, there's a constant back and forth between the people on the rocket and the people in what nowadays we would call mission control. That, again, is a bit more realistic than what you saw in a lot of science fiction of the time. The assumption in science fiction of the 50s is that people would just get on a rocket and autonomously go wherever they wanted to go. But everything we know from real space programs is that the people in the rocket are really just a subset of a massive team. And there's sort of a hint of that with these sort of mission controllers that we see. I've forgotten the name of the character. Is it Baxter?
Yes, Baxter, who eats his own tie because he's so stressed.
Yes, he does. Finally, we get the landing back on Earth. And again, some really beautiful drawings. There's one of the rocket sort of descending, and you see the land below it, where you see the clouds below it and the land and the sea. And it's just like what you would see if you looked out the window of an aircraft.
And it's funny because, you know, historically, Hergé was criticized in his first albums for not being very accurate, especially on foreign cultures. You know, he was a Belgian living in Belgium, and Belgium never having left his country. Maybe he went to France or Germany, but that's about it. And it was very, you know, as any European would see Asian people or African people, it was borderline racist, you know?
Mm. Right.
And one day he met a guy named Chang, a Chinese man in Belgium, and he told him, everything you're saying is completely wrong. You have to fix all this. And he did. So he improved his research a lot after this. He read a lot about foreign cultures and techniques and engineering and all that stuff to be more accurate in his stories. And it really shows here.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, you read Tintin from the first stories and you read this, it's amazing how much it evolved over time.
Yeah. I was afraid that if I looked at them, I might find them childish. But in fact, I didn't find them childish at all. And the fact that you've got the stupidity of Thompson and Thompson, and you've got Captain Haddock, who's always trying to get himself drunk,
yeah,
means that these are barely suitable for children. Okay, and then the final section, of course, there's this sort of building tension at the end where the people on the ground realise that the people on the rocket must have run out of air by now. And so as soon as the rocket lands, it's quick, let's get it open, let's get some oxygen to those people. It's nice to see that they are fine at the end. And Captain Haddock, once he's recovered, well, he pours himself a drink. And somebody comes up to him and says, here's the whiskey you ordered, sir.
Nevertheless, we can go full spoilers, I guess, at this point. You do have two deaths in that storyline.
True,
You know, Wolf and Colonel Boyce die. And, you know, for quote-unquote children's stories, it's not that common to have actual characters dying and not, you know, in a remote way, you know. Boris, you almost see him die, and Wolf, he leaves a note that he sacrificed himself to leave them some air to go back.
Yes.
Because he leaves a postscriptum explaining why he did that, and he said, maybe by some miracle, I will survive, or I'll be found, whatever. And Hergé did not want to put that in. It was the editor who said, you need to leave a way out for that character, because otherwise... The Catholic Association won't leave us. Let us publish this. And in Belgium at the time, they were very strong, you know. So it's part of the publishing rarities of the time. You know, you could not have that. that's also part of the reason why you have almost no female characters in those stories, is, you know, they thought it would be bad for morals.
Right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. There's incredible depth to these stories, which I wasn't expecting, and I found them very pleasurable to read. I have problems with the Spielberg film, but I do wish they had done more of them. And if they had gone directly from the Hergé stories, I think they could have done some good work. And I would love to see these two books adapted into a movie.
Yeah, I usually love Spielberg, but that's an example of something I don't like from him. His adaptation of Tintin, as you said, the storyline is just convoluted and doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
I don't know why he did this. You know, he had the material to do a fantastic thing, and he, and I know he can. I mean, as I said, I love Spielberg most of what he did. I don't know why. I don't know the story of the production and writing of that movie, but I didn't care for it, really.
Yeah.
Isn't the Spielberg movie an adaptation of two of Hergé's works, though?
Yes. The Crabe aux Pinces d'Or, I think, where he meets Haddock for the first time. And the other one was...
Red Rackham's Treasure, maybe?
Yes, exactly. When he finds the treasure, yeah.
Colin, your final thoughts on Tintin?
I enjoyed this. It made me want to read more, and I was especially excited to hear that Nelvana, who is an animation company out of Canada, who has made another series that I really enjoy, has been making adaptations of these, and that they're currently available on Amazon Prime, so I can watch them for free and in the comfort of my home. So, looking forward to getting some more Tintin.
Tintin.
I recommend them. They're nice. Tintin, yes.
Tintin.
We'll get him, Phil. But they're very nice. I do recommend them. They're very nice. They're well made. The music is nice. I don't know for the voice acting in English, but in French it was fantastic. So it's really a nice series. It's just fun to watch, even at 77 year old.
I'm not quite there yet. We'll have to do a review in 24 years.
Quiz time. And Emmanuel, I think you might have something for us.
It's going to be a bit different from your usual quizzes.
Okay.
I have 9 questions. Whoever has more points wins, I guess.
Okay. Do you want us to call out our answers, or do you want us to write down our answers and then compare notes?
Call out your answers.
Okay.
The theme, of course, is the moon, and I'll try to have some French stuff in it too.
Okay.
First question. What is the first novella that evoked traveling to the moon? Clue, it's a French one.
I thought it might be. I'm wondering if it is From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne.
No, it's not.
Oh.
But good guess. Colin, do you have a clue?
I'm drawing a blank. I can only think of the movie by Méliès. But I think that's based on a French novel, but I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah. I have another possible guess. I can't remember the name of the work, but I wonder if the author was Camille Flammarion.
No, but I see why you mentioned him. I will give you another clue. We talked about this when you did an episode like a few months ago, and I mentioned that novella in an exchange on Twitter.
Oh!
But it was a few months ago, so...
No, I can't remember what that was.
It's okay. So it's Histoire comique des États et Empires de la Lune, which means Comical History of the States and Empires of the Moon, but is a writer who's famous, Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, of course.
The real
yes.
one.
Oh,
and that was yes. written in 1655.
Yes.
And he actually uses a rocket to get there.
Yes. We reviewed some story that was inspired by it. So, yes. But I'd forgotten old Cyrano. How do you pronounce it? Do you say Cyrano? Is it the emphasis on the first syllable?
Cyrano. Cyrano de Bergerac. Yeah.
Cyrano. Okay. Mm. We tend to say Cyrano.
Yeah. So, second question. In his novel De la Terre à la Lune, or From the Earth to the Moon, written by Jules Verne in 1865, what is the mean of transportation used by the astronauts to reach the moon?
Oh, I think I know this one.
I do too.
Do they travel in a huge bullet fired from a gun?
Yes.
Yes, they do. So, 1 point for both of you, because you both had the answer. Next. So, I think this one's going to be easy. Which French movie from 1902 is considered the first science fiction movie ever?
Colin?
That's From the Earth to the Moon.
Yes, there you go.
I knew that as well, but I knew Colin had already mentioned it, so he should get the point.
Okay, next one. In which novel do the characters living on a lunar penal colony revolt against their rulers, aided by a technician and a remarkable computer? It's not French.
Ooh.
I think I have this one. Mm-hmm. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Right answer.
I would not have guessed the title, but I was going to guess that it was Heinlein.
Yes.
Next. This one is on music, so maybe Colin has an advantage here. I know he's a musician. which classical music piece from 1905 is an adaptation of Verlaine's poem Clair de Lune, meaning moonlight?
I know of a piece of music called Clair de Lune.
Mm-hmm. Which one?
I don't know who wrote it.
I don't know.
Okay, so it's Clair de Lune from Claude Debussy. In the Suite Bergamasque. You can hear it in Ocean's 11 and more recently in the science fiction movie Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Ah.
Fantastic movie, by the way.
I should have just named a French composer.
Moving on to the next question. So, which 1975 British TV science fiction series is set on the moon after it's been knocked out of orbit?
Space 1999.
I thought you would know this one. In French, we called it Cosmos 1999.
Oh, really?
Oh,
yeah. Not space, which is espace. They said Cosmos. Sounds better, to be honest, in French.
Mm.
So, next. On which lunar site did the American astronauts of Apollo 11 land in 1969?
How specific do we need to be? Is a C specific mm-hmm. enough?
Yeah. Yes.
I know the answer to that one, then. Colin, do you know it?
I do not.
Ooh. Then I'm going to leap in and say the Sea of Tranquility.
Correct.
Yay.
Next question. In which 2009 movie does the actor Sam Rockwell play a character performing duties on the moon, only to learn that he is a clone with an expiration date?
I think I know this.
I know this one too.
Shall we say it together after three?
Sure.
One, two, three.
Moon. Yes.
There you go.
And if those two utterances weren't in sync, I will put them in sync in the edit.
It's good to have an audio editor.
So right now, Phil is leading by 1 point. So Colin, you can still tie him if you get the answer on the last one.
Okay.
So this one is from Tintin. So in which of their adventures are Tintin and his friends saved by the moon?
I don't know this one.
I'm too busy trying to figure out how the moon could save you. Is it something to do with moonlight or the reflection of a moon in something?
Not exactly.
No. I don't know, but I'm going to guess Red Rackham's treasure.
No. No. I'll give you the answer, because if you don't know it, you cannot guess it.
Okay.
It's in the story Prisoners of the Sun, published in 1949.
Oh.
So in that story, Tintin, Haddock, and Calculus are about to be burned alive on a pyre lit by the sun outside an Inca palace.
Wow.
But Tintin was allowed to choose the precise date and time of the execution.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And he made it coincide with a solar eclipse that he read about in a newspaper. Believing the sun was their ally, the Incas let them go.
Wow.
Brilliant.
So Phil wins by a point.
Hooray.
Good job, Phil.
Oh, thank you. What was the name of that story again?
So it's Prisoners of the Sun in English. And it's actually a two-parter also. That's the second part of a story. The first one is the Sept Boules de Cristal. So I presume the seven balls of crystal or something like that.
You know what? I think you've just given me the next Tintin book I'm going to read, because that, what you've just described, that makes that a piece of science fiction.
Does it? Okay.
Yeah, it's using scientific knowledge to inform the outcome of a story and to inform a character's decision. Science fiction. Thank you for the quiz, Emmanuel. I appreciate the work that you had to put in to come up with the questions.
It did take me some time to put together.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's very good. Thank you very much. Now, as we're approaching the end of the show, we've got time for our quick run through past, present and future items. Colin, do you have a past item?
I have two. I have been doing more work out on Project Gutenberg to save and adapt old science fiction into ebooks. And there's some really wonderful lay bracket coming down the line in probably about 6 months that people should check out.
Interesting. You pronounce it lay. I pronounce it Lee. I wonder which is the correct pronunciation. I've heard a lot of Americans call Ms. Brackett lay bracket.
Well, I'm sure a listener will call in and correct us, which I really do appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
The other one is I found on PBS, in a remembrance of the Columbia accident, an interview with Octavia Butler. And I have not yet had time to sit down and listen to it, but I'm looking forward to doing that and getting her perspective as a science fiction author about the accident and, you know, what drives people into space. And
was that a recent anniversary?
Yes, I want to say it was February 1st.
Right.
Was the 20th anniversary.
My God, how time flies. Emmanuel, were you able to come up with any past, present, and futures?
Yes. For the past, I want to recommend an old French sci-fi movie. It's actually a comedy movie called La Soupe aux Choux, which means the cabbage soup.
Okay.
It's with Louis de Funès, Jean Carmet, and Jacques Villeray. So it's a 1981 comedy in which an alien lands on a farm and meets two farmers. Both of them are drunk, and they basically welcome him. He cannot speak, and the only sound he's able to make is...
It's a comedy.
It's a low-budget affair. It's very, very silly, but it's very fun. And it has a nice original score. Very early 80s with, you know, synthesizers. So if you want to have some fun and see some old French comedy with a sci-fi setting, The Cabbage Soup is here, the movie to go for.
Very good. I've got a past item here. It's sort of past and present. It's present in the sense that it is a website, but it's past in the sense that the website is about the past. And we've probably mentioned it before, but it's called Sci-Fi History, scifihistory.net. And I've looked at it before, mainly because it has, for every day of the year, it has a whole list of things that happened on that date. But only the other day did I discover that there's a whole other section to the website, which is a kind of a blog, and it's got some really interesting articles. So scifihistory.net. What about present items?
I'm a Star Trek fan, and right now both Picard and, properly pronounced, Picard, and Discovery have continuously disappointed me. I mean, I just don't find them to be very good series. Strange New Worlds feels a bit better,
yeah,
but I'm still not sure. I just want to say the last sci-fi movie I watched, which is pretty recent, is Prey. I don't know if you watched it.
No, I haven't seen it.
Colin, have you seen it?
No, but I mean to. I like the Predator series a lot.
Well, it's not bad. It's entertaining and quite well shot, actually. The problem of the movie is the very bad French dialogue in it. There are some Frenchmen in it, and it's Google Translate quality.
Oh.
And it's often spoken by non-French speakers, and it did take me out of the movie. It's frustrating because they do have a couple of Quebecois actors in there, you know, actual French speakers. And they don't really have lines, and they would have been a lot better than the, I don't know where they're from, the actors they hired to do the French guys. But, you know, that's Hollywood understanding and respect for foreign cultures for you, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't want to rant, but, but the movie itself is good.
Okay. My present item is Reader's Awards. We're at that time of year where many of the science fiction magazines are having their readers' polls. So both Analog Magazine and Asimov's science fiction magazine have put their stories online. I'm not sure if all the stories are there, but most of them are there so that you can read them for free. So I'll put a link on our website, which is 101sf.blogspot.com. So if anyone wants to kind of bring themselves up to date with the best of science fiction short fiction from the past year, that's always a good way of doing it, is just have a look at what are the award nominees. Colin, do you have a present item?
It's almost the end of February, which means next month. No, I have to wait a whole other month after that. Oh, no. I participated in a Brandon Sanderson's, you know, record-breaking Kickstarter, which will publish 4 novels in 2023. And I was so looking forward to getting the next one because I really liked the first one. And then I realized the next quarter doesn't start until April.
So it's not a present item, it's a future.
Almost present. Almost.
Almost present. But as I've pointed out before, this section is so deeply flawed because people listen to this podcast months after it's released. So, you know, when we say a thing's in the future, it's already in the past for most listeners. So
Yeah.
I don't know why we bother. Anyway.
But you have time travel, science fiction here for you.
Yeah. I've got another present item, actually, which is Neil Clark, the editor of Clark's World magazine, has been very troubled of late by people using AI to generate fiction and then sending it to magazines. And he's reporting that this is becoming a major problem for him as an editor. He wrote this: since the early days of the pandemic, I've observed an increase in the number of spammy submissions to Clark's World. And what I mean by that is there's an honest interest in being published, but not in having to do the actual work. Up until recently, these were almost entirely cases of plagiarism, first by replacing the author's name, and then later by use of programs designed to make it your own. And he goes on to say that towards the end of last year, there was a big spike in plagiarized material arriving on his desk. And then he says, and then AI chatbots started gaining some attention, putting a new tool in the arsenal of these plagiarists, and encouraging more to give this side hustle a try. And he gives a little graph showing the number of stories that have been rejected because of plagiarism or these kind of totally AI nonsense pieces of writing. So I thought that was a really interesting side angle to this whole discussion of how clever AIs have become at generating text that sounds as if it's been written by real people. So he sees that as a real problem.
Well, especially for these magazines that are run on such a small budget and are volunteer-based in some cases.
Yeah. What about future items? I don't think I have a future item. I think I did have one, but I didn't type it in, so I've not got it in my notes. So can any of you rescue me with a future item?
I do. I don't know if you, Colin, has one too.
I don't, actually. I'm still trying to find the next great science fiction read for me.
So it's all down to you, Emmanuel. Give us a future item.
So mine is a TV series, actually. It would be the second season of Foundation. I really enjoyed the book series by Asimov, and even the prequels and sequels, except the very last book, which I found a bit dull. But the thing about this series is that it's beautifully shot.
Yes.
And it's very adapted. You know, they took a lot of liberties with the original material. But I still don't know if I like it or not. That's the thing. Usually after half a season or so, I know where I stand, but not here. There is still a lot, so I'm really looking forward to season two to actually make up my mind on that series.
Yeah, it's interesting because it has the characters and it has the very smallest nugget of the Foundation series, but then it goes off and does something all on its own. And I often wonder why they bother then with the name instead of saying, you know, inspired by. It's really not adapted from.
No, you're correct. It's inspired by. It does have Psycho history, does have Harry Seldon, but everything else is completely new. And as I said, I still don't know if I like it or not. I don't know if I'm tainted by the original books, which I enjoyed a lot. I don't know.
I still haven't seen any of it. I was quite taken with some of the early reviews. But I think by about episode 3, most of the reviews had turned negative. So it put me off. So I haven't gone there yet. I have just found my future item.
Oh, good.
And that's another TV series. It's one called Extrapolations, which is coming out in the middle of March. And it's an anthology series. I think there's only going to be 8 episodes. But it's an anthology series that is all about the effects of climate change through various points of view. And the stories, I gather, are going to be interconnected in some way. Now, not sure that that in itself makes it interesting, but when you look up the person behind it, who's somebody called Scott Burns, or Scott, I would say Scott Z. Burns, but he's probably, because he's American, it's probably Scott Z. Burns. He is the person who wrote the script for the Steven Soderbergh film, Contagion. He also wrote the screenplay for The Bourne Ultimatum. And he was the producer of the documentary film An Inconvenient Truth. So this is somebody with some very interesting credits, both in fiction and in non-fiction.
Interesting.
Quite how that's going to turn out, I don't know. It's coming from Apple TV, so it's called Extrapolations. Do we have any other past, present or futures?
No, not on my side.
Not from me.
So, yeah, I think we've covered everything. So Thanks to Emmanuel for helping us navigate the world of Tintin. And Emmanuel, I think you should tell us about your own podcast and where people can find you on social media.
Yeah, thank you. So my own podcast is called Lafayette, We Are Here. It's a French history podcast aimed at the American public. So I do one episode a month. You can find it on lafayettepodcast.com or on any podcast platform that you use. And I cover pretty much any subject, you know, from Napoleon to the Hundred Years' War, whatever I feel like at the moment. And I try to do palatable episodes, you know, around 40-ish minutes or less than an hour anyway, for anybody that wants to get into some aspect of French history.
So thanks, Emmanuel. Colin, any final words?
I don't think so. I think I'm good.
So thanks for listening, folks, to our first international three-way link-up. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Kusky. Our theme tune is from purpleplanet.com. Look for the show notes on our website, which is 101sf.blogspot.com, where you can also buy us a coffee through the tip jar. And you can also find us as Science Fiction 101 on Facebook. And finally, please follow us or subscribe to us on your podcast app. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we also appreciate the odd 5-star review, which will help our visibility on the various platforms.